Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benouli. Today we have Youssef Al-Mouayed and Professor Peter Klein. Youssef is a businessman from Bahrain who lived in China and the U.S. during his studies. He's been managing the family-owned business in building materials since 2010. He's been studying the Austrian School of Economics and other social sciences since 2012. He applies Austrian economics to business, management, and accounting. Professor Klein is the Karl Menger Research Fellow of the Mises Institute and W.W. Carruth Chair and Professor of Entrepreneurship at Baylor University's Hankamer School of Business. He is also a senior research fellow at Baylor's Bau Center for Entrepreneurship and Free Enterprise, an adjunct professor of strategy and management at the Norwegian School of Economics. His research focuses on the economics of entrepreneurship and business organization with applications to innovation, regulation, and economic growth. He's authored and edited 5 books and has published over 75 academic articles, chapters, and reviews. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hello, glad to be with you.
Thanks for having me.
Great. I thought we'd do a discussion focus on the Austrian School of Economics and how it applies to organizations, to business in the industry, in the real world, how it can be applied, what are the techniques of doing that, and if there's any measures of effectiveness that we could look at it as well during that process. So just to begin, if you can begin a discussion with your career background in the Austrian School of Economics and at Mises, maybe we can begin with Professor Klein.
Sure. So I'm a professor at a business school. I've been in the higher education sector most of my career. I was trained in sort of conventional economics as a graduate student, but I was aware of the Austrian school, even from my college days. And as you know, most of your listeners know, the Austrian school, so-called, named, given that name because its founders were professors at Vienna in the 19th century. The Austrian school was at the time one of the dominant sort of mainstream approaches within economics, but over time has become a little bit more marginalized, where now it's considered a kind of unusual or niche or heterodox approach within economics. I'm sure most of your listeners are aware of this in general. So I was trained in a business economics department and was always interested in not only the kinds of Austrian school issues that many people are interested in, like the free market economy and economic growth, business cycles, the gold standard, and so forth, but also in the more what you might call micro applications to entrepreneurs and to firms and to strategic planning and so forth within the organization. And I found it very useful to develop and apply Austrian insights into those kinds of problems. One issue that we can talk about later in your show is in terms of how the Austrian school is perceived within society, right? Within kind of mainstream economics, it's perceived, as I said before, as being a little bit of sort of a fringe movement. But among business academics, journalists, pundits, and of course, business practitioners like Youssef, you know, even if they haven't heard all of the specific Austrian lingo or familiar with the names of Mises and Hayek and Rothbard and so forth, when you explain basic Austrian principles to them, it makes a lot of sense. The light bulb, you know, sort of typically comes on. And so I've been fortunate to be, you know, able to develop those connections, not only in my, you know, sort of day job as a professor, but also in working with the Mises Institute in helping to sort of develop the Austrian school and spread the word of Austrian economics to students and business people, and policymakers, journalists, and so forth.
Great. Very interesting. And Youssef?
I want to start by saying in during my education, my main interests were math and science oriented things. So I was more interested in engineering, and later picked up, computer science and programming. But social sciences weren't really an interest of mine at the time. So that's the path I took, and I studied subjects along those lines. So I had no background in business, except for my family being a business family. Like, they have a lot of interests in business, and they do talk about it casually, during lunch or wherever. So I do have some, secondhand exposure from them talking about it. And so when I came back, I heard Ron Paul talk about Austrian ideas, and because I lived in many countries, I got to see many countries working and their markets, their institutions, and their governments, the way they work. So I got to many of the things I heard resonated with my own experiences. So from there, just out of interest, I started educating myself. So when you mentioned, we talk about the Mises Institute, I started obviously from their website. So we first found their materials on their website, and I realized that it's a vast website with a lot of resources and books, all for free. And I started from there. My path to educating myself started from listening to lectures in the car, to reading. So that was all I was doing for a few years, and it took some time to be able to apply these insights. But immediately upon starting, I noticed that you can it's very realistic, and as you're learning it, you get a lot of insights, and you can, let me put it this way, you can narrow down on what's going on. You don't get exact answers, but it seems to be a realistic way of thinking and a practical way to look at things. And from there, I mean, Professor Klein is the main person that was able to connect this body of knowledge, body of theoretical knowledge, like man, economy, and state, and human action, and was able to bridge the gap between those books and the managerial literature. So earlier when I was studying, I used to read lots of books by Harvard Business School, and they wouldn't make so much sense to me. But now, through the help of Professor Klein, I was able to, treat all of this as a unified body of knowledge, and it just added, more layers and refinement to my thinking. And it definitely helps you make better decisions at the end of the day.
Very interesting. Yeah. Let's explore that connection you mentioned, Yusuf. Professor Klein, where do you see the principles of the Austrian School of Economics that would be applicable towards managing and leading organizations or businesses?
Well, it's interesting that, as Yusuf mentioned, he had a technical background in math, science, statistics, and so forth. It's often, there's a perception out there that because Austrian economics is typically the theories are typically formulated verbally rather than with mathematical equations, and some of the historical work is qualitative rather than quantitative. There's a perception in some circles that the Austrian school is kind of softer or less rigorous. But really, a better way to think about it, in my view, is that Austrian economics is more humanistic, in the sense that it starts with basic propositions about human beings and some anthropological assumptions about who we are and how we act and how we think. And it draws a sharp distinction between the purely natural world, the physical world, of molecules and particles and the movements of bodies through space and so forth, and the social world, which of course interacts with the natural physical world, but the social world that's characterized by thoughts and plans, beliefs, expectations, goals, striving to achieve goals, right? Mises' famous book is titled Human Action. What does he mean by human action? Well, action for Mises is defined as purposeful or goal-oriented behavior. No, physical objects don't pursue goals. When you drop a stone, it falls to the ground because it's following certain physical laws, not because it has a desire to be on the ground. It prefers to rest on the ground rather than, you know, be floating up in the air. But if you say, hey, Peter Klein, why did you agree to be on this podcast? Well, my behavior is not pre-programmed in a way that I have no choice but to engage in certain physical movements, you know, to be on your show. Rather, I have certain purposes. I enjoy talking about Austrian economics. I like, helping to sort of spread the word about the insights of the Austrian school. I think that can help make the world a better place. Or maybe I have a big ego and I just like to see myself on a Zoom call. Whatever it might be, you know, I'm doing this to satisfy some particular ends that I may have for myself or my family or for the world. That is an example of purposeful human action, according to Mises. So Austrian economics starts with the presumption that the way we think about the social world, the way we think about things like purposeful behavior, uses kind of a different language and a different way of thinking than the way we would do chemistry or physics or biology or astronomy or whatever it might be. So this sort of humanistic or person-centered approach is extremely useful, indeed is completely necessary for understanding commercial activity. To use a famous metaphor, if you imagine sort of alien beings who have, they approach the Earth and they have some kind of a telescope or something, and they were to, you know, be able to peer in through the window and see the trading floor of the New York Stock Exchange. And imagine that these are really alien aliens who live in a completely different kind of an environment than ours. You know, what do they see through their telescope? Well, they see these creatures, you know, with two appendages on top and two on bottom, moving rapidly through a space, and they're waving their appendages like this, and they're moving this part, and they're pulling up little pieces of paper, and they're looking at colored screens, and there's a lot of kinetic energy, a lot of movement. I mean, these aliens would have, they have no hope of ever understanding what is going on unless they have concepts like buying and selling, right? Concepts like property, concepts like price, and the desire to buy low and sell high, or profit-seeking behavior and so forth. In other words, you know, you need this kind of theoretical structure of understanding the purposes behind the things that people do to make any sense out of it. You know, any practical business person will tell you, oh, I'm trying, you know, I'm producing a product. I've got these, these pens, and I'm trying to sell these pens on the market. I need to understand my customers. What do my customers want? What are my competitors doing? What are some ways that I could make my product desirable to the consumers? How do I evaluate ex post if I'm successful in my pursuit of making money or protecting my family or getting my product out there, whatever my goal might be? I mean, there's no way that we can make sense of commercial phenomena without using the basic concepts elaborated by people like Mises about choice, scarcity, pricing, resources, and so forth. So the Austrian school, because of its emphasis, because of its sort of human-centered rather than purely mechanistic approach, is uniquely well-suited to understanding practical business problems. And I think that's what a lot of students I've talked to over the years, professionals, experienced professionals like Yusuf, have reported back, that they'll often say, oh, I took econ classes in college, but they were, you know, they were not useful to me. I thought they were dull and uninteresting. But then you talk about economics from an Austrian point of view, and practical people say, oh, well, yeah, of course, that's what we do. Thank you for providing me that language that term. I didn't know that term, but what you described is exactly what we do every day.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. And your thoughts, Yusuf, on the principles applicable towards managing and leading businesses?
Let me start from the things covered by Professor Klein. You know, when you're looking at, when you're trying to find a problem, I mean, for me, Austrian economics has been really useful in narrowing down on where the problem's coming from. So if you start from the individual analysis. So you need to get into the motivations of the individual. So that means, you know, are his goals, his personal goals, are they aligned with the organizational goals? So you have to look at, the person and his actions and see if they align or they don't. Because I would be thinking, okay, this is the logical thing to do. He should be doing this. His job description says he should be doing this task within and should try to do it as fast as possible. But when he isn't, maybe he's paid more if he takes a longer time, you know. These are the types of problems that I started uncovering. And, you know, people say talk is cheap because it doesn't cost you anything to say something, but it costs you in action when it comes to making choices. There is a cost to your choices. So if you want to know if certain people are aligned or not aligned with the organization, you need to go drill down to the individual actions. So the organization starts from these individuals and you work your way up to the organization level when you look at things. So this is key just the basics stuff, like from, you know, chapter one of many of these big books, the stuff is there of how to look at human action, how to judge people's preferences and from looking at their actions and gaining a deeper insight into people, into their motivations. And there are, of course, positive aspects like motivating people and setting targets and instead of catching negative things, there is also that. So this is the exact thing that Professor Klein said is where I felt immediately grounded in this reality of human action. And I was addicted to looking at things from this point of view after I got it.
Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind my jumping in for just a moment, also, there are some other, you know, more specific terms and concepts that Austrians emphasize, like the concepts of opportunity cost, scarcity, trade-offs at the margin, this notion of thinking about the effects of small changes in behavior on outcomes was pioneered by the Austrian school in the late 19th century. That was one of their great accomplishments. That's an insight that has now been absorbed into more mainstream thinking on economics, though not always used in the same way that Austrians use it. The notion of the subjectivism of value, right? That the value, for example, the value of my product I'm trying to sell on the market, the commercial value is not determined by some intrinsic or physical characteristics of my product, but rather as it's driven by how that product is perceived subjectively by the consumers, the potential consumers of my product. What Austrians call methodological individualism, the idea that to explain aggregate outcomes, group outcomes, what a team does or a company does or a society does, you can't act as if the group is thinking and choosing and pursuing its goals. You always have to break that down into the motivations and plans and behaviors of the individuals who constitute that group and then sort of aggregate up. So besides the general ideas that we've been talking about previously, there are also some more technical concepts that were pioneered by or are most thoroughly embraced by Austrian economists, and they're extremely useful in business decision-making.
Can you elaborate? Oh, sure. Go ahead. Yes, sir.
I just want to add one more thing. So what I talked about in terms of human action, this is on the inside of the organization. There's a lot more that can be said about the market price, for example. When you're explaining market prices, in our understanding, all market prices are the result of human action. So you can break down, let's say, the reason why a price dropped. You can go and you should be able to explain that. So if you mastered your market, if you truly understand your market, any price changes, you should be able to explain it in terms of certain actions of individuals or organizations in the market, buying and selling, abstaining from buying or selling. So you should be able to explain all price changes that happen in your specific market. And, you know, each industry is quite narrow and you know, they all, like in any industry, you kind of all know each other. And you should be able to identify what happened to cause these changes in the market. The thing that this knowledge gives you is it allows you to drill deeper and go really deep into the explanation of what just happened. And it sets a really high bar because you'll not explain it completely, but you need to get you need to be able to interpret what just happened in the market when you spot any changes. So this is also applicable to, you know, anticipating what competitors are going to do. Just from a price change, you would be able to come up with a whole story of what just happened, and you'd know exactly where to focus and what other details you can safely ignore.
Great. And Professor Klein, can you elaborate on those techniques or methods of approaches in terms of managing and leading organizations and businesses with real world examples in industry?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's maybe useful to think about problems that can arise when one neglects to embrace these concepts fully. Opportunity cost is a classic example, right? That, you know, some business people tend to think of costs purely in terms of dollar outlays, right? So to develop a product, to put it on the market, it costs me, you know, this many dollars of R&D and this many dollars of investment expense and so forth. But I mean, the cost of developing a particular product and sending it to the market is not only the dollars you spent in development, it's the, you know, the alternative goods and services that you could have developed but did not because you invested your time and your capital in developing the one that you had. You know, should I hire this employee? Should I, you know, expand my production facility? What the entrepreneur, what the business person should always be comparing is the expected benefits of pursuing that particular action and compare that to the potential benefits of pursuing some other action, right? We see this in public sector decision making all the time. I've been doing some research and engaged in some conversations about government support of technology and innovation. And as you probably know, your listeners know, you know, there's been a lively debate for many years, but in the last 4 or 5 years, the pendulum has kind of swung away from the idea among sort of mainstream thinking that, you know, Silicon Valley and the internet and the iPhone and all these other technologies are the result of the free market and, you know, these brilliant entrepreneurs, Steve Jobs and so forth. Now a lot of intellectuals are saying, no, it was really the government, that gave us all these innovations. Because if you look at the history of many of these technologies, you see that in many cases, at some point in their development, there was some kind of government support from a grant or some kind of a product developed in a government lab. And so people conclude from that, oh, well, the more the government spends on science and technology, the more cool and useful stuff we'll get. There are many problems with that argument, but there's a very fundamental opportunity cost problem, right? That government resources, government spending doesn't just, you know, it's not free, there's always an opportunity cost because those resources have to, are essentially transferred from the private productive sector to the government sector and then spent on the activities or given to the persons or companies that the government is closest to or that the government favors. So, you know, when you look at the U.S. government, for example, spent so many tens of millions of dollars developing technologies in the 1950s and 60s, some of which were then used by internet companies. The relevant question is, well, what kind of technologies would we have today if those resources had not been taxed away from the private sector and given to universities and government labs and so forth, but had been used by entrepreneurs competing in the marketplace to produce alternative goods and services? In other words, we might have even better technology than we have now if the government had played a smaller role than it did in, you know, sort of interfering with the market. Likewise, a manager might say, hey, look at this fantastic, you know, we made X dollars of profit after we introduced our new and enhanced model. Well, what if doing so involved killing a bunch of other possible lines of investment that were being considered or pursued at the time that would have yielded an even greater and even more lucrative product or service? It may be that the decision to pursue A rather than B actually destroyed value because it took resources away from the more promising activity B and gave it to activity A for whatever reason, right? That may be resulting in a net loss, even though on paper it looks like a gain. So opportunity cost reasoning is very fundamental to all kinds of practical decision making. You can also see in my example the notion of subjective value, right? To give a very practical example, think about the smartphone industry. You know, up until 1997 or 98 or so, you know, there were two companies that dominated the global handset industry, BlackBerry or Research in Motion, as the parent company was called. And our fine Canadian brothers and sisters are very familiar with that.
Not too far, yeah, from here.
And the Finnish company, Nokia, right? Those two dominated the business and the consumer sections of the handset industry, respectively. And was all sort of blown away by the introduction of the iPhone and the move towards these, you know, tablet style touchscreen devices. Now we have the Apple sort of Android dominance of the marketplace. Well, you might remember, you know, it's easy to look at famous statements in hindsight that proved to be spectacularly wrong. Like, you know, what's his name? Watson from IBM supposedly said, you know, why would anyone want a computer in the home? You know, back around late 70s, early 80s. Okay, well, we all make mistakes in the face of projecting forward is difficult. But you might remember one of the co-CEOs of Research in Motion, upon viewing the iPhone, you know, made several disparaging remarks. This is a toy. This is not a serious device. And one of the guys, I think it was Lazardis was his name. He said something like, why do you need all these apps? The only app the user will ever need is a browser. And so the BlackBerry devices had an internet browser, but the notion of an app store and this kind of what we would now call an ecosystem between the handset manufacturer and the app developers and the app store and so forth, that was not anticipated at the time. Right. So there was a huge opportunity cost in continuing to pursue the old BlackBerry model. The managers, the executives at BlackBerry, they simply could not grasp that consumers preferred having all these cute and fancy features and being able to play games and, you know, over the practical functionality of the physical keyboard and the other features that BlackBerry's engineers or RIM's engineers had assured them were more important. For serious business, you need a device like this. We don't care what these consumers think. They're wrong. You know, Steve Jobs famously said, or is reported to have said, we don't do marketing research at Apple because consumers don't know what they want until we show it to them. In other words, we're so innovative that we produce products that have never been seen before and everyone will immediately want them. I mean, we get the point of that of that remark attributed to Steve Jobs, but it's not literally technically true, right? Steve Jobs can certainly not compel consumers mm-hmm. to prefer his product to the product of another firm. And of course, Steve Jobs himself and Apple have had many, many failures to go along with their spectacular successes. So failure to appreciate that value in the market is subjective and in the minds of consumers is something that has led many firms astray. These examples also highlight the role of uncertainty. And this is something that was emphasized by Mises in his treatment of entrepreneurship, that entrepreneurs, you know, in the real world, unlike some mathematical model, we don't know with certainty what will happen tomorrow. So the entrepreneur is always trying to anticipate, or to use a word that Mises used that I've embraced in my own work, the entrepreneur has to judge the future or exercise judgment about what future market conditions will be like. And the entrepreneur cannot know with certainty at the time that decisions have to be made. So fundamental concepts like opportunity cost, subjective value, and uncertainty are really critical to commercial success, and not thinking about them seriously can cause all kinds of problems with business decision making. Maybe Yusuf can elaborate on those with some examples, better examples than the ones I used.
Well, I'll tell you this: the marginal thinking that economics makes you see the world. Like, for example, you're making a decision. I can give you an example, like fresh from 2 hours ago from the office. So we're looking at upgrading our IT infrastructure. So we need to make decisions on certain features and how much we're going to spend. So what I would ask, I'd ask it in this way. I'd say, okay, what is the marginal value of this feature? And if we, let's say, go for the cheaper option, what am I giving up in terms of capabilities? When you, let's say we're having a discussion on launching a product, we have to internally debate what is the marginal value of, you know, each feature. Oh, we'll give up this feature. We'll put this feature. So this thinking along the margin is a very interesting way of looking at things, because, you know, things that have value, they come in units. You know, I mean, a piece of cake this big, you know, I don't think anyone would want that, but you need a decent sized piece of cake to, you know, be able to sell it. So these units that we, when we think of things in terms of these units. You know, how much more should you spend on something? What are you going to gain? This is the opportunity cost when you're looking at, okay, I expect to get this benefit, and in terms of some investment in, let's say, IT or machinery, and whether you get that benefit or not, you can later go back and review that. So if you look at your accounts with this perspective, you'll be able to see a lot of things that, you know, the accountant himself may not see by himself. You know, this knowledge integrates, you know, the accounting with what's going on in the business. Even just understanding the role of the entrepreneur, what is that role and what is your role? Defining that role clearly is very interesting, and it is something that rarely people discuss. What exactly does an entrepreneur do? This is useful for you understanding, you know, for creating an organization. This is a useful discussion, even though it is, you may think, theoretical, but it has a lot of implications for how you manage an organization.
And in the past, with your management of your businesses there, Yusuf, have you been able to identify techniques that you've used from the Austrian School of Economics towards, you know, maybe getting more performance, higher productivity, net profit increase Are there examples you could provide in that regard?
Sure. I mean, it starts from, you start from recruitment, you selecting the right people, understanding what their values are, setting their expectations. Also, when they're joining your company, they're also performing an entrepreneurial judgment on you, on your company. So they're deciding, should I join this guy or no? And after they arrive at the, in the company or in the country, they're going to see, okay, what you told them is what this guy told me during the interview. Is all of this true? Did he set targets for people and did he reward them when they reached those targets? So these set norms for the employees joining and management that's joining. It starts from there, and if you gain these insights, if you have insights into the market and you speculate correctly, or you negotiate your prices correctly, if you read the signs correctly, you should be able to get a competitive advantage. Understanding people definitely helps you in motivating them, finding the right people, motivating them, developing their innate capabilities, curbing some of their bad tendencies if they come out. But, it's a process, an ongoing back and forth process in the organization. So I learned a lot about people and interacted with more people and got better people. I go myself to India and interview managers.
Very interesting. And a final question would be, in terms of how can this approach of using the Austrian School of Economics for managing and leading organizations and businesses, how can that approach be made more aware and inculcated into industry? And just overall, this goes together with how the Austrian School of Economics is perceived in society. Professor Klein?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, in a sense, what you've described is an entrepreneurial venture of its own, right? Not in the commercial sphere, but in the intellectual or idea space. So what people like, what we're trying to do is achieve the objective of making the Austrian school better known among business professionals and others who are interested in entrepreneurship and firms and industries and technologies and so forth. How do we do that? Well, like any entrepreneurial project, there's uncertainty. We have to make some investments now. We do some business planning. We look at possible future scenarios, and we try to invest our time and energy and our other resources where we think we'll get the highest return. But it's impossible to say ahead of time exactly which strategy will be the most successful. So what does that involve? That involves us engaging in activities like the one we're doing now, right? Talking about the Austrian school, talking about the ideas of Austrian economics to people like the listeners of your show. Obviously includes writing articles and books and being engaged on social media or other platforms that are good for communication and dissemination of ideas. But there are also some more tangible projects. For example, Yusuf and I are both involved in a new initiative of the Mises Institute called Mises for Business, which is designed specifically to promote the kinds of ideas we've been discussing today, with a website and with some tutorials and videos and classes and written materials and so forth. So I think, there are larger, more tangible efforts like the Mises for Business project, but there are also smaller kind of everyday efforts that we make in terms of talking to people locally or even globally about these ideas, making suggestions of things that they can read and study or watch or listen to. And, a little bit at a time, I think that we can move the needle towards greater awareness of the Austrian school within this community.
And your thoughts, Yusuf?
I just want to say something. Many of the insights of Austrian economics have been applied to politics and the state as an organization. But many of these insights also have they play a role in an organization in terms of a private organization. So if you look at Mises's book, Bureaucracy, you do have, you know, bureaucratic structures inside companies, and having an understanding of a pure bureaucracy, you know, you would be able to simulate how things would happen within a company if you did things a certain way. Other books that are political, like, you know, Democracy, The God That Failed by Hoppe, that is fundamentally a time preference argument. And you can build organizations that have a high time preference and they're only looking at the short run. So you should look into these things. How do you make the organization have long run goals? So that is, he's using that for making a political argument about political organizations, but this is a private, but this thing also is, it's in human nature. So it also has its role in the organization. And as Professor Klein pointed out, Mises's argument against socialism is fundamentally a cost accounting argument, that you cannot calculate costs, which also has its implications inside a private company and in private organization. What I want people to see is that, okay, yes, you can get these insights into, you know, states and governments and other kinds of organizations, but you can also get insights into, you know, management and private organizations. So this is the fundamental thing. And many people that I met at some educational events at the Mises Institute, they never saw this, you know, this private management or applying it to business side of the Austrian school. So I, you know, with a group of other people, we take an active interest in bringing people's attention to what Austrian economics has to offer to managers and business owners and entrepreneurs, and help them do a better job at whatever they're doing.
Great. Well, it's been great insight. Gentlemen, how can our listeners learn more about your work, and are there resources or websites where our listeners can go to learn, understand more about the Austrian School of Economics and using its principles towards business? I mean, you mentioned the Mises for Business and other types of resources, Professor Klein.
So your readers can find links to these, to the Austrian literature and a lot of the ideas we've been discussing at the Mises Institute site, mises.org. Our friend Hunter Hastings also runs a podcast called Economics for Business that is an Austrian school, Austrian-themed podcast series, interviewing people like us and many others about applying Austrian economics to management and other practical business issues.
Great. And Yusuf?
These are the same resources that I use, and I'm interviewed also on. We're both interviewed on Economics for Entrepreneurs, and we both plan to participate with this Econ for Business community once it's launched. I mean, you could sign up if you're interested, and when it's launched, you'll receive an email.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.